Hip politics, baby.
Welcome back to another episode of the Hip Politics Podcast. Welcome to the Hip Politics family and the Hip Politics Podcast listeners. We're growing, growing, growing. I just was checking the data analytics. Do you know we're one of the fastest growing podcasts in Middle Indiana? It's just a little random fact. Anyways, welcome back, everybody. It's your boy, your host here, Mr. Cameron Calvin Trimble, a.k.a. Mr. Cameron Calvin, a.k.a. Mr. Hip Politics, a.k.a. Mr. 216 to the 202. Another solo episode here. Unfortunately, my co-pilot, Mr. Michael McQuarrie, is busy being the mayor of Capitol Hill and doing Capitol Hill type things. But we had such a special guest, and this was such a special day for her. I had to jump all over the opportunity. Somebody I've known for a few years that is a special guest here on the podcast. She's a leader, period. She's also a leading woman, period. Also a leading Black woman, period. So there's we'll try to see if you can guess who it is. She was named a PR Week's 40 Under 40 list. She was also recently named Ebony Magazine's on their Power 100 list of influential African Americans. She most recently served as the Director of Public Engagement for the Senator Elizabeth Warren's presidential campaign. You may have seen her on TV, on radio, and other podcasts over the years, her various roles at Planned Parenthood. And she also even served all the way back in 2012 on President Barack Obama's reelection campaign. She is a leading voice for women, a leading voice for Black women, strong social media following. She's gonna be in part of the ColorCom conference coming up. You can find her all over the web, and I regularly steal her posts and quotes from my Instagram and try to fake it like I have some in-depth knowledge. No, but it's coming from our guest here today, Miss Alencia Johnson. Hi, Alencia. How you doing?
Hey, Cameron. Thanks for having me.
No, thank you. I'm honored. I am. Like I said, I think we officially met at that panel for Congressional Black Caucus.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. I forgot about that one.
It was only like 2 or 3 years ago. And then after meeting, we quickly realized like our circles are quite concentric and they're quite overlapping. And
yeah.
Know a lot of the same people. And ever since, I've just been a big fan of the work you do, your voice.
Thank you.
You've just been a powerful voice, both in the real world and I think even in social media. People regularly have reached out, I would say over the years, and like, oh, do you know her? Or have you quoted her? Like, it's funny when, you know, people are impactful when stuff they did or said comes back to you and they have no idea you know them.
Yeah.
It's a little awkward. No, it's but cool.
It is cool. It's just like kind of like, it's still very like, oh, I'm just trying to do the work here. I'm trying to free Black folks and women.
No. And the work is shining through. Like I said, it's reaching the average person, like men and women alike. So I guess that's where we'll start. What is it that drew you into, I guess, this career of kind of being such a champion for Black women?
Yeah. Well, actually, can I also say the way you said that I served President Obama's reelection campaign many years ago was like, I'm old. Like, it's, yes, it was
that's 2012, eight years ago. Not many years. I'm old. I was on the 2008. I was on 2008. That's how I got into politics. So I'm trying.
But it's crazy that, like, that is still, like, a long time ago. Like, 8 and 12 years ago is a long time. So we're old in the game. Like, this is why Gen Z is looking at us millennials crazy.
Exactly. And it's, I mean, time is moving. I think, I mean, even with this crazy year that we've had in 2020, it already felt like 2 years have passed.
Yeah.
In 6 months.
Goodness. But your question on Black women. Mm-hmm. So I grew up in Virginia. I'm actually here right now, sheltering in place with my family, my parents. I grew up in Virginia, daughter of a pastor. My mom is
PK
one.
PK too. I'm a PK.
PK. And my mother is one of three daughters. And then my grandmother, while she was one of 17, I really only knew like two of her brothers, but I knew a whole bunch of her sisters. So I say all that to say, like, I grew up with a family full of Southern Black women who are very opinionated. And it's funny, I tell people, you think I'm talkative in settings that you see me in? No, when I'm around my family, I ain't got nothing to say. Cause like, they like, girl, shut up in the corner. Like, let the grown folks talk, right? And so I grew up with so many women doing amazing things, whether in their community, or my aunt is also a minister and she's battling a lot of sexism from being a woman who preaches, to the, my mother climbing the corporate ladder, all of that. And my grandmother, who she really is, God rest her soul, my kindred spirit. And, you know, she would have me at bake sales, but she'd also have me when she's volunteering for a governor's race or Obama's election. She was instrumental in every single thing that I did, but also said that you have to do the most good with all that you have. And you have to do the most good for people who don't have the opportunities that you do. And I am so blessed that I found myself in so many rooms that many folks who look like you and I, many women who look like me, don't have the opportunity to be in. But my grandmother taught me at a very early age that you have a responsibility when you have a seat at the table. And if you can be the vessel for people to hear more Black women, if you can also be kind of the microphone. I used to want to be a reporter. And part of the reason I wanted to be a reporter was because I believed that more people who looked like me would be engaged with politics and would be engaged with what is happening in the world if they could identify with someone who looked like them. And so that level of representation was always there for me. And then that also understanding the duality of what Black women face, whether healthcare or, you know, economic injustices, and the fact that, like, we are the loyalist voters, we have the best spending power, we are, and I'm now one of the many, we are the fastest growing demographic of entrepreneurs, we are the most educated, and yet in so many inequities, we are at the bottom. And so how do you use the gifts that you have to, I want to liberate everybody, but I believe when you liberate the most marginalized, which I believe are Black women, you could push that further with Black trans women. When you marginalize people who are sitting at the intersection of oppressed identities, everybody else is going to get free. So that it's been instilled in me since I was, I actually don't have any other way to live beyond being a champion for Black women in all of the spaces that I'm in. And you know,
that's how you know you're doing what, that's how you know you're doing what you're called to do. When you, yeah. when people ask you that question of like, why are you doing this? It's like, 'cause this is what I'm supposed to be doing.
Yeah.
Like, this is all I know.
Yeah.
Like, I wake up and this is what these are the thoughts in my head. This is what's been, God has put on my heart and spirit.
Mm-hmm.
And and you know you're doing what you're supposed to be doing because of the impact and the effectiveness of your impact. I want to scale back just recently, which again, like I said, feels like a lifetime ago, but was only a few months ago. Let me make sure I have this right. You were the director of public engagement for Senator Elizabeth Warren's presidential mm-hmm. campaign. I caught you, I think I may have DM'd you a few times, like, yo, I caught you on TV, or caught you in a picture, caught you in a few pictures or something like that.
Or randomly in the spin room.
That was right. Very random. That was good. That was actually a really good that I had. I'm glad I had a few people on some of those campaigns because I was able mm-hmm. to pull a few interviews. But question, very basic, but I'm curious. I know so many people are curious. What's it like to be on a national presidential campaign? What was that like at that level?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I am fortunate and blessed that I have seen it from going as I was a surrogate coordinator on the Obama campaign in 2012. And every position matters, absolutely. But that was obviously a more, you know, entry junior position to being senior staff for one of the front running campaigns and the most important election in our lifetime. To see both of those has been truly a blessing and an honor. And there is a lot of pressure though, right? To come from a place where I spent 6 years at Planned Parenthood, and we over there, we were progressive and we like pushed on agenda. And yes, Planned Parenthood Action Fund helped elect a lot of champions like Senator Elizabeth Warren, but they also held people accountable. And so to coming from being a person who holds electeds accountable, even your favorite electeds accountable, to working within it was an interesting switch I had to flip. But I, every day I went in and the job was different. I was joking about this earlier today on a conversation of how, like, my second day, I hadn't even moved to Boston yet. I was still living in New York, but I flew up to Boston for my first day. And then they're like, get on a plane and go to Detroit. We need you to be on this panel at the NAACP. And I said, I don't even have all the core messaging yet, right? Like, I don't know all her plans yet. Like, wait a minute. Okay, I got this.
They picked the right woman for the job, because even
they did. I guess.
I remember I caught you. What was it, in Atlanta, at the seat at the table? Like, I got to see you do your thing in person a few times, and you were definitely engaging in, and were able to translate that message. And that's very interesting when you talk about how the speed of
it. You got to be ready
and being ready.
I mean, even that seat at the table time, literally my coworker said, I didn't know anybody had to speak, but like, can you give some remarks? I said, oh, great. But no, I was thinking about prepping the surrogates that are coming to do the spin room, right? Like, I was just, it's just all these competing tasks, and always in my position, I'm being more held accountable by the public, by our supporters, by voters, by surrogates, by groups. Like, I was part of the linchpin that was between their communication with the campaign, and particularly because we were so policy focused, like,
she had a plan for that.
She had a plan for that, right?
I bought a t-shirt
because it's history, right? And you know, being able to, you know, one day it is literally meeting, event, then the next day it's prepping her for a big rollout around the criminal justice reform plan, which was literally my first job, like, big task on the campaign, to the next day, this is some internal work, and I got to fly down to South Carolina or go to Nevada and spend time with their communications team. It literally, because I was at such a high level, in addition to doing my task, I also had to be able to move and be flexible and be nimble and whatever they needed me to do. And sometimes some people say I did things out of my purview, but it was because they needed someone to do it. And, you know, if I could get on the flight and get there, all right, we'll do it. So it was a blur. Like, those 9-10 months, I can't even count how many months it was. It was a blur.
When did
it happen so fast?
Yeah.
Started in July. Yeah.
Oh, wow. Yeah. It was a blur. I got a question. You're an insider. You think she's going to be VP?
You know, I can't speculate on who I think he's going to choose, but I will say, and I'm sure you probably got some K-High followers, but like, Elizabeth Warren is my choice for VP.
Interesting.
She is. And it is not a knock on anybody else that's in the conversation at all, because like, the reality is, you
said
K-High.
First of all, that went over my head for a second when you said K-High.
Listen, my mentions, it's hard. Okay, so let me say, okay, the hardest part about all of that is, like, people who observe these campaigns on Twitter, they don't realize we're all friends, right? Like, Tamia's on Cory Booker's campaign, you got Jaleesa on Kamala, Kirsten on Kamala's campaign, Simone on Biden's, Nina on Buttigieg, like the list goes, like, we all, not only do we all know each other, we are all on, like, a group chat, right? Like, so we all are
committed. No, I know, it was quite funny to see how it shook out. I'm like, y'all kick it.
We all kick it, because at the end of the day, we are about Black women getting what we deserve. And some of that is making sure we are at the table. And so if all of us just went to one campaign and say that campaign didn't work out, what are we going to do with the nominee? We don't have any negotiating leverage.
That
so
makes sense.
That piece has always been frustrating. And I just mentioned that only because, like, my mentions at times had been out the wazoo. And I'm like, y'all, I know people on the black candidate staff. Like, we're all friends, and we're really good friends. And
I think that's something that people, and the reason why I really wanted you on the podcast, just to even kind of talk like this, in the sense that outside of our, I guess, our bubble, our political bubble, and so forth, so many people just perceive us through Instagram, Twitter, TV when they run into you. The one or two times if they do see you, it's when they come to, like, CBC or something like that. But they don't realize, like, just the same way you and I are connected, like, all the people you mentioned I'm either cool with, know, or actually even friends with, and so many other people that we just all have realized. I think this generation of Black political leaders, we realized that we needed these seats at the table.
Yeah.
I think the Obama administration did such a good job of empowering so many younger people when they were in their 20s and early 30s. So now that we're in our 30s and 40s or even late 20s, but 30s and 40s, that we got opportunities to have voices a lot earlier than, say, two or three generations of political of kind of political surrogates and insiders beforehand. And I think that's very important because you're a perfect example of a person who's not just at the table, but an empowered voice at the table, bringing your full self and being able to push certain issues and certain narratives to people just otherwise may not have heard that.
I will say just quickly to that point too, that is why she is my choice for VP, because of I know who was at the table, not only at the table building her policies and positions, but I have had one-on-one conversations with her about race and about systemic issues. And there is a reason that all of the plans that she and the campaign we put out, we were rated by two different ratings that having the most progressive agenda on race and the best agenda on racial justice. And so, you know, there comes a point as we are advocating for diversity that we have to say, okay, we've been pushing white people to get it, to do the understanding, to do the research. At what point are we going to be able to say, oh, actually, I trust them, and I believe that they actually might be the best one for me? So listen, Elizabeth Warren, I ride for her, but I also know that, like, I have always been the Black woman navigating these very white women spaces, and, you know, the family, like, y'all trust me, the people I know trust me. Exactly. Like, people know who they can call on. They know that I'm not going to get to the table and, like, sell out my people just because I want to keep my seat at the table. They know that. But, you know, the Gazers, they don't know that. And as my platform expands, hopefully they understand that I can be a trusted voice for all Black folks.
Stay encouraged and stay empowered on that. I mean, you're right. I know you mentioned your mentions and so forth, but if we operated by our mentions, nothing would get done.
That's right.
You can't do that. Just a couple quick more questions. This is Hip Politics. Our whole theme of the organization, of our various podcasts that we have on the network, is really to educate, engage, and immobilize the hip hop generation, which is now a multi-generational, multi-ethnic kind of community. And one thing I'm a strong advocate that I think the hip hop culture, hip hop artists, hip hop music, you're starting to see it now with certain different voting initiatives, and now with the various ever since the murder of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and Ahmaud Arbery and all the racial justice demonstrations that have proceeded in the laws and the things that are changing, you're starting to see different groups of entertainers. And there's just a new group formed by a bunch of different influential hip hop artists and music managers to push either voter education, voter empowerment, racial justice issues. I'm curious, because I consider you're part of the hip hop generation. What do you think hip hop's role is in this election cycle? How could they help influence this election?
Well, I think they have a great responsibility. I mean, I'm old, young enough to remember Fight the Power, right? My father was also a hip hop head too. And then I remember the Vote or Die campaign that Diddy did, and my mentor was his executive director at the time, and was behind all that initiative. And the reality is, hip hop, that's symbolic in Blackness, but hip hop shapes culture. Is, you know, the statistics show that even people who are over here waving these Confederate flags, they still get down to hip hop. They listen to it, right? And hip hop has actually become such an outlet for Black people. It's also been a leader in culture. And the only way that we can get the policy changes that we really want is if mainstream culture catches up and starts talking about that. You have three times as many, I don't know the stats, but I'm just throwing them out there, probably 15 times as many people reading The Shade Room versus watching MSNBC when it comes to young Black people. And so there is a responsibility for those outlets, which is why I love that the Young Black and Fabulous, that blog, my soror Natasha, she's doing a politics vertical to uplift young Black men running for office. And so
YBF's doing that? That's dope.
YBF is. And Natasha's been talking about that for years, that she wants to bring, she knows how responsible she is to the culture to bring that. And that's why I'll say this. I'm grateful that there are entertainers, there are hip hop artists who are saying a bit more. I'm also grateful that some who have been doing their work privately are actually talking about it more too. I want people to be a little conscious of what they're saying, to be able to say, we're gonna hold our vote hostage, when like, you can stay in your gated community and you can stay in your mansion, but your family that you came from cannot, like the hood cannot, right? And so I wanna push us that, yes, let's have this conversation around Joe Biden and the presidential, absolutely important. But in those off years, let's actually really talk about the issues. If you're talking about criminal justice reform, you need to rally people around these district attorney races. There are only, I think it was—
district attorneys, sheriffs.
Sheriffs.
Sheriffs, judge, school boards.
Yep. School boards, because then that will make sure we get the police outside of our school systems. And I believe it is, don't quote me, it's either 9 or 13, I can't remember how many, but either way, that's too damn low, excuse my language, Black women district attorneys in the entire United States. Literally, I was with District Attorney Rachel Rollins out of Suffolk County in Massachusetts, and she said, oh yeah, it's only a handful of us, so few of us that we have a group text. And so I challenge hip hop culture because of the responsibility, and that's part of the work that I'm trying to do now, is bringing culture into politics and vice versa. Take your platform seriously and responsibly and educate beyond the presidential, because if you built the political power up until the a presidential year, then you actually have a lot more credibility and can move people to action.
Very true. And something that just popped off that I see you're about to be moving people to action, various organizations and agencies. Tell me about this. Is it 10? Do I pronounce it 1063 or 1063? Yeah. 1063 West Broad, because you kind of slipped in earlier, like we're the fastest growing, which I guess I'm a part of now, entrepreneurs. As the chief impact officer and the founder of 1063 West Broad, social impact agency, please tell me more about that.
Yeah, so this comes from, again, the inspiration of my grandmother having the, she could be fly in her fur coat and her red lipstick, but also be about the people, and that she was her authentic full self and was still doing so much good. And over the years, I started my career at GEICO, then the Obama campaign, then 6 years at Planned Parenthood, then Elizabeth Warren. And the thread through there is that I was always a part of how are these organizations pushing for change of the most marginalized people. And we're having conversations about the responsibility of major corporations, of lifestyle brands, so like beauty, fashion, all of that, as well as the entertainment industry and tech. Majority of people are paying attention to these industries, but what is shaping our politics and our policies, our advocacy groups, our activists, our organizers, how do we marry them together and humanize experiences at a really a natural level? At a massive level. The other piece that I got frustrated with is, you know, I do love a nice gala and nice dinner. I like getting dressed up. I do. But 50,000, exactly, you do too. We see each other at the game.
And we see
each
other all the time.
I love getting my CBC wardrobe together, no lie, I do. But I also get frustrated with the corporate social responsibility cycle, the pattern. We're gonna give $50,000 to this table, we're gonna give $100,000 to this conference. These galas and these conferences are very important. However, that $50,000 could actually fund a program. That $50,000
a full program for a whole year.
A full program with two staff, right? Like, you could do so much more with that money. Or you want to talk about racial inequity and the fashion industry. Actually, why don't you look internally first and figure out the pipelines that you're building? And then you could make this public statement. Then you could change your, what the perception of your organization. And so there, I say all that to say, these are just a couple of examples of connecting the 360 dot of how to have move impact to action and to do it in a sustainable way. The LGBTQ movement is a really good example of a movement that has done the sustained effort with corporate America and the entertainment industry, from Ellen and Will and Grace to major corporations coming out on behalf of Pride. And then decades later, you have Supreme Court wins, right? We have to shift mainstream culture to be supportive of all of these issues so that we can get the policy wins. So I say all that to say is I have a ton of relationships in so many different industries, and the only way for me to be able to connect them was to bet on myself and go out on my own. And
that's a good bet. I'd put some money on that bet too.
Thank you. It's kind of scary, but it is actually a blessing because
this is scary. This is, trust me, entrepreneurship is. But I will say this: I'm a praying man. I'm a praying man.
Same.
And I realize that it's actually, I don't know. Do you are familiar with Alva Street? I was just listening.
Oh, Pastor Wesley. That's Pastor my Wesley.
Yeah, yeah. So I was just, I work out, half of my workouts, I work out to various sermons. Uh-huh. And the one I was doing today is actually a 6-year-old sermon on faith, but he just said, he's like, faith is risk. Mm-hmm. It's like, it is scary, but if you are a person of faith or you do bet on yourself, that risk, there is no reward without risk. And as
that's
you
mentioned, right.
you've both set up a public profile, but also backed by real work.
Thank you.
To do what you're trying to do. And it sounds like it is a needed industry. Like I totally agree with you when we go to so many of these cool events and you get to dress up, you get to hobnob with whoever, have a great steak or chicken dinner but you look at, as a person who, like, my background has been, how I even got into all of this was through throwing parties in, like, the scrappy way. Like, that's how I even got into comms and literally throwing parties.
Yeah.
Got how I got into communications and politics. And knowing how much I could stretch a budget and still, but the what people saw is like, oh, that this must have cost all of this. It's like, no, I know how to maneuver. Mm-hmm. But you see how mm-hmm. much waste goes into that pomp and circumstance. And there's a reason why that it needs to be there, because it draws in the money. It draws in a lot of the eyeballs and attention. But now when you work with so many more community-based organizations and activists and advocates on the ground, and you realize like $20,000 and $30,000 and $40,000 could go so much further in terms of like true on the ground impact. I think mm-hmm. somebody who's speaking up for and having an agency that can truly connect some of those big dollars to some of those local impact in, or you know, I mean, organizations and so forth, I think is just such a needed niche and space. So I wish you the best of luck on that.
Thank you.
How can people find out more about 1063?
You can go to 1063westbroad.com and it gives you more information about the services that we provide.
Okay. I'll make sure to check it out. Yes.
You mentioned Pastor Wesley and being a person of faith. I'm going to say this too. I think that those of us, this is a whole nother conversation, but like those of us who are people of faith in this work, Jesus needs some new people or like a better organizing strategy, because like the conservatives have co-opted the narrative of who he is. And I
talk to my dad about this all the time. My dad.
Listen,
my dad
Jesus was a black man with hair like wool who was an enemy of the state and was a feminist. Okay, the government killed him. That's in the Bible. He flipped over tables and a week later, they killed him. Like, let's have that conversation.
The least of these. Oh my man, my dad is a United Methodist bishop of the state of Indiana now. But he came up, I mean, he's grown up as a community pastor, and he's actually a person, he was always like the youngest and or first black or insert one of those at every level as he's grown. And we talk about it all the time. I send him different things. I'm like, get your boys, get your people. And he's like, God has a wide tent. Like, we've had a podcast with like several bishops and talking about like how the church connects to the hip hop generation. Like, believe me, I think they have co-opted the narrative, and mm-hmm. When people hear evangelicals, I think they're just,
and
that is a whole nother conversation, how they've co-opted that narrative. But
I think you and I, like people like you and I living out loud, like our faith is living out loud too. It just, it shifts again, shifting narratives and shifting culture, because evangelicals are small, but very loud, and they're white men. They have a lot of privilege and power, but they're not the majority.
You're right. And I think there's so many, even kind of going back to hip hop and so forth, in the sense of, at first, when I started the platform, people kind of like, well, hip hop is all misogynistic and this. I'm like, yes, there are. I'm not going to. Some of my favorite songs are, I can't defend them. But the generation and its impact in the culture, like having also having worked at record labels, having worked with everything from independent to national artists, when you actually talk to the people and understand the people, not only in front of the microphone, but behind those artists, they're real people who care about real issues, are real people of faith, are real people mm-hmm. who are just trying to figure it out. And you, and when you kind of get to that level under, and understanding that, like, there's so much more to the culture than just the things they want to attack. And so why I kind of, I feel totally comfortable living out loud in that.
Yeah.
It's in a hip hop and a political space.
I love it.
In closing, you're not getting away without this. So we do this thing on the podcast. It's from barbershops to even Chris Rock made a movie about it. Like, I literally think it's the oldest hip hop debate there is.
Oh, but God.
It's not a debate. This is just, there's not a lot of pressure on this. Top five dead or alive. Who is Alencia Johnson's top five favorite MCs? Mind you, dead your mentions alive. Won't blow up because this is your favorite. You could say whoever.
Yes. This is my favorite.
This is your favorite.
I'm not getting into that debate of all time, who everybody thinks.
Exactly. But you'd be surprised just over the course of like, we're 65, 70 episodes in now, and all the various people, like the various kind of answers you get and who likes what, it continues to shock me. So
yeah,
I'm quite curious as to who your favorites are.
So I wouldn't be me if I didn't shout out the ladies first, from Salt and Peppa and Missy Elliott. And Missy, for me, because she's just like production, lyricist, hip hop, R&B, and we both from Virginia. Point of privilege.
BA, two up, two down. One of the best music video. I think literally she may hold the record for the best music videos of all time in hip hop.
Listen, like, that magic of her as the artist, Timbaland and Hype Williams, like, I mean, I just, Missy, hands down, I don't think she gets enough of her flowers. It frustrated me when she came out with Katy Perry at the Super Bowl and all these little kids were like, who is this? I was like, nope, we're not going to do that to Missy. So I also love Tupac. The thing about Tupac is, to what you said earlier, there's a lot of misogyny. He was very problematic. There's some questions about some of his interactions with some women. But I also appreciated how Black he was. Like, his mom taught him so much just about us as a people. And in his own way, he was talking to the hood about a lot of different things. And in a way, I think, you know, you could kind of compare to, like, Nipsey Hussle, right? God rest his soul. So, love Tupac. And also, because I'm like an R&B neo-soul type of girl, I love Talib Kweli. Get By is one of my favorites. Common. I hate being like, oh, I love Common. And everybody's like, oh, he's so mainstream now. But like, older Common. And like, he's talking about.
There's nothing wrong with liking. Why can't people allow their people to grow and get successful?
That's true.
He glowed up. He glowed up.
As he should have.
And he growed up. He grew up.
Listen, Common showed up for Planned Parenthood a whole lot of times. So, like, he has grown a whole lot. But, like, one of my favorite lines of one of his songs was, it don't take all day to recognize sunshine, right? Like, I love Kanye. I love Common. Especially, like, Chicago hip-hop. Yeah. You know, there's some others there that I love, too. There's some others that were from Chicago who I loved before their recent wife and their political conversations. But we just gonna leave it as Common is the Chicago MC. So that was five, right?
That's
five. Missy, Tupac, Talib,
Salt Pepper, Missy, Tupac,
Common.
Talib, Common. Okay.
Yeah.
That's solid. That's solid. Well, Alencia, I thank you. I know this is a super busy day for you. I just want to say thank you in person, well, in digital person, but thank you not only for doing the interview, but just thank you for all the work you're doing. Thank you for being a truly stand-up woman and how do I put this? You've been an example that I can easily point to when women or people in general, but definitely so many women are like, oh, I'm looking for mentors. I'm looking for people to, how do I get to this career? Because I like to work with a lot of young people, especially that whole intern class every time they come in. Like, I'm always big on that because somebody had to bet on me as an older intern to even break into the political space in the game. And you're one of the people, like, easily, oh, here, check her out. Like, very easy to go to. Like I said, I can always count on the things that you put out publicly to be insightful, informative, and then also loud in a good way. Like, oh, like, I'm glad somebody's, like, boldly saying these types of things. And so I think this next step, 1063 West Broad, I know is going to be very successful. The natural evolution on that. Whenever we finally get back outside,
2021, 2022. 2021, Lord Jesus, this vaccine is coming.
You taking that vaccine? Can we say Tuskegee experiment?
Okay, so now I'm going to plug. Thank you, first of all, for all that. But I'm going to plug this live that's on my Instagram. I did it with one of my dearest friends. She is a geneticist. She is the first Black woman to get a PhD in genetics at Vanderbilt. We had a very long conversation about the vaccines and all this stuff. You will be pleasantly surprised. So go listen. But be skeptical, but go listen. It's not going to be a Tuskegee experiment.
Okay. No, you're right. You're right. And I'm
it's okay. Kinda...
That's a complicated we have to have those conversations. There's apprehension, not just in Black people. Mm-hmm. I think the also just with so many corners being cut at the FDA and all these things under the Trump administration, it gives me pause, but you're right. I do think we need this vaccine, and hopefully in this herd immunity, I want people to continue to stay safe. Stay sheltered in place. Who cares what you see on TV? Sheltered in place and continue to. I have this thing that I've started, like, get up and get it. Like, I've been working out way more, and I always, every day, I leave a message like, come out of quarantine better than you went in.
Yeah.
Just as an opportunity. There's no FOMO. You're not missing out on anything. Mm-mm. Like, if you see a few people out at brunch or stuff, or let them be there, because they'll be home in a couple weeks.
me and Rona ain't trying to be friends.
Right? Exactly. So, but I say that to say, in 2021, when I do get to see you again, big hugs. Thank you again. Thank you. Good luck beyond good luck and blessed on the endeavor. Thank you for joining the Hip Politics Podcast. Make sure everybody, you can continue to tune in on all podcast platforms, from Anchor, iTunes, Apple, iTunes, SoundCloud. And then you can also catch us and subscribe on YouTube.com/Hippolitics. Again, this is your host, Mr. Cameron Calvin Trimble, aka Mr. Cameron Calvin. You can follow me on all social media. And we've had a wonderful guest, Alencia Johnson. Alencia, can you drop your social media real quick?
Yep, it's just my name, at Alencia Johnson, AlenciaJohnson, on Twitter and Instagram.
And they can also follow 1068 West Broad on social?
Yes, 1063 West Broad is on Instagram.
1063 West Broad, sorry, 1063. Yep. Let me make sure I get that right. So thank you to Hip Politics Podcast listeners. This has been another episode of the Hip Politics Podcast, and we are out. Peace. I do some weird.
Bye.
Hip Politics, baby.